Okay, Shalom Aleichem, everybody. Hope you're all staying warm. Personally, I always find it annoying when you see somebody outside and they tell you, stay warm, because it's a lost cause. It's not going to happen. But hopefully everyone is warm, everyone is well, and excited for the mini series that we're going to be doing over here, beginning tonight, Mirza Hashem, continuing over the next few weeks with some of our exploration of Megillas Esther Unmasked. Now, it's Tu B'Shvat's coming up, so that means it's already time for us to get into the Purim mode. Maybe some people are always in Purim mode, but if it's time for us to start to get into Purim mode, and I called the title of the series Esther Unmasked because the goal that we're going to have for the series is we're going to, in each shiur, really focus on one of the key personalities of the Megillah, and show how there is so much more behind, each of the people who were introduced to as children and were taught the story as kids, and it's like a nice, fun story, and we sing, and we have games and everything. But as we explore the Megillah, we realize there is much, 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 much more to the Megillah than meets the eye. In fact, the Megillah is clearly written that way intentionally, as Chazal were very well aware of. And the time we're going to have the next couple of weeks is really just going to be enough to begin scratching the surface of that, but hopefully, even scratching the surface will be a very rewarding experience. So we're going to begin this week with Achashverosh. I'll load up the source sheet in a second. I'll also share it in the chat. And I chose Achashverosh as someone to start with because even though we think of the Megillah as Megillah's Esther, so we have to choose who's the pivotal person in Megillah. I would say Esther, maybe second place would come Mordechai. And as we'll see, in many ways, Achashverosh himself is really the person to focus on as the pivotal person of Megillah. In fact, and I'll load up the sheet, here we go. I titled the first shiur, Megillat Achashverosh. It's obviously not Achashverosh Megillah, it's Megillat Esther. But as we start looking from really just the beginning, Esther does not appear in the beginning of the Megillah. Everyone knows the Megillah begins by he be me Achashverosh, hu Achashverosh, hamolech me'adu v'yad kush, sheva ve'asir me'ya medina. We're told Achashverosh's name twice. Then we're told he's a king. We're told he's a great king. He's a tremendous king. He's a king of 127 countries. The way the Megillah begins, it's Achashverosh's story. Esther doesn't show up until Perek Beis. Mordechai doesn't show up until Perek Beis. Haman doesn't show up until Perek Gimel. The Megillah begins with Achashverosh's story. Not only that, but the Megillah ends with Achashverosh's story. The Perek Yud is so overlooked. Baruch Hashem, we're going to come back to these psukim at the end of the Shir series. The last Shir I hope to do will consider Purim as a whole. After unmasking some of the pivotal personalities, we'll try to unmask Purim as a whole and some of its message for those of us in Galus, and even those of us who are privileged in Eretz Yisrael still spiritually live in Galus. But the last parak of the Megillah is very, very cryptic, and it ends with telling us Achashverosh raises a tax. That's when we all boo. The only time we boo besides for Haman. But then Pasuk Bey is the weird pasuk. The Megillah tells us the Chol Maaseh Takfo Ugvuraso, all of the acts of might and power of Achashverosh, Uparashas Gedulas Mordechai, Asher Gilo HaMelech, and the king who raised up Mordechai, Halohim Ksuvim. If you want to do further research, Al Sefer Divrei HaYamim L'Malchei Madaya Paras. If you want further research into the legacy and the glorious career of Achashverosh, go look in the chronicles of the kings of Persia and Medina. Now, that's very, very strange. Because not only is the Megillah beginning and ending with Achashverosh of all people, not Mordechai and not Esther, but this terminology for a king is classic in Tanakh. It's how the Tanakh many, many times will wrap up its discussion of a certain Jewish king. So I just put a couple of examples. Literally, I put the first couple of examples from the beginning of Sefer Malachim. Rehavam, the first king after King Shlomo. So after Sefer Malachim wraps up his career, what does the Navi tell us? The yes, it's Divrei Rehavam, everything Rehavam did. Halo imak suvim al Sefer Divrei HaYamim l'Malchei Yehuda. You want more Rechavim information? Go look up the Chronicles of the King of Yehuda. You want to learn about Nadav, the son of Yeravam ben Nevat? Hello, Inksuvim al Sefer Divrei Hayamim l'Malchei Yisrael. Whenever the Navi finishes telling you about a king, it says you want to know more about him, go look in the Divrei Hayamim of Yehuda. Go look in the Divrei Hayamim of Yisrael. That line about Achashverosh, Guraso, you want to know about his Gura, his mighty deeds? That also comes from the way Tanakh describes the activities of the Jewish kings. Just as an example, Chizkiyo, Malachim Beis, Yasa Divrei Chizkiyo, V'chol Gura. So, all the mighty deeds that Chizkiyo did. Now, the Navi can't talk about the mighty deeds of Rechavam or the mighty deeds of Nadav, because those kings were kind of pathetic. But Chizkiyo had mighty deeds. Gura, so, you want to find out about his Gura? Go look once again. Halohim Ksuvim Al Sefer Divrei Hayamim L'Malchei Yehuda. The exact same phrase is what we have over here. So what is the Megillah telling us? When the Megillah ends the Megillah by saying, you want to learn more about Achashverosh and all the amazing things he did, go look in the chronicles of the kingdom of the kings of Persia and Media. It's telling us that we just read the story of Achashverosh. So what's going on? That's not how the Megillah should end. It should be, you know, you want to learn more about Mordechai. More about the life of Queen Esther. Queen Esther definitely appeared in the Sefer Divrei Hayamim, but that's not what the Megillah says. It begins with Achashverosh, it ends with Achashverosh, and it explicitly ends in a way, the exact same way it ends by wrapping up the story of a Jewish king. Megillas Esther really is the story of Achashverosh. That is what the story tells us at its beginning. That's what the story tells us at its end. And so now we need to figure out why would that be? Because it's obvious to us, isn't it? I mean, isn't it obvious that the Megillah is not Achashverosh's story? Like, of course, isn't it the story of Mordechai and Esther? So what does it mean that the Megillah is calling it, is portraying it as the story of Achashverosh? So there's no question that one answer could be, and this is a good one, is that this is a classic misdirection of the Megillah. All the time, the Megillah, part of the theme of V'nahafachu, which maybe we'll explore a little bit tonight and definitely more in the coming weeks, is, you know, it always seems to be X, but it's actually Y. So it could be, you could explain that way. You could explain the Megillah portrays this as the story of Achashverosh, but then you read it, V'nahafachu, it's actually the story of Mordechai and Esther. And there's a lot to be said for that approach. But I think that the Megillah actually really means what it says. When it is telling us that the Megillah is Megillat Achashverosh, that this really is Achashverosh's story, and it really behooves us to understand what is the trademark character trait of Achashverosh, which makes him in so many ways the pivotal personality to understand what the Megillah is all about. So with that as the mission that I think is pretty clearly set up for us, let's begin exploring what I think is, you know, the key theme of Achashverosh for us to demonstrate. And we know when it comes to Achashverosh's personality, he's got a loud personality. We know he's a drunk. We know that he can be cruel. We know Chazal already argued, was Achashverosh an exceptionally intelligent king, or was Achashverosh an exceptionally foolish king? It seems like both are correct. You know, on the one hand, so many things he does, you're just so unimpressed. On the other hand, there's no question that he's managing to keep everything under control. But I want to suggest that the key to begin understanding Achashverosh, and the Megillah really lays it out there for us in the beginning, is his emphasis on putting on a show. Achashverosh is extremely invested in the idea of showing off externalities, right? Presenting a certain face. We get that literally the first thing he does in the Megillah when he starts his party, Perek Aleph Pasuk Dalid. So we've barely finished sitting down. You still hear the little kids, you know, trigger grogger going off as they sit down. You get the Pasuk Dalid. What does the Megillah already tell us? Behar Oso Es Osher Kavod Malchuso. It wasn't just that Achashverosh makes a party. The goal of the party is to display, liharos, to show, to display his incredible wealth, the es yakar teferes gedula. So in all the glory of his greatness, yamim rabim, shmonim umas, 180 days. the goal of the party is for Ahasuerus to put on a show. And if we're not convinced that this is the key, or a key, to Ahasuerus, the Megillah doubles down on this 7 psukim later. Because the idea of leharos, of showing off what you have, comes up yet again. When Ahasuerus commands Vashti to come to the party, and of course the Megillah uses the exact same word to bring Vashti Amalka lefnei Amalach, bechasar Malchus, bring her with her crown, leharos ha'amim ha'sarim es yakito vasmar ehi, to show off his queen. So he's showing off his riches, all his gold, his silver, his beautiful vessels in the palace, and he is showing off his wife, right? This is Ahasuerus putting on a show. Chazal are completely attuned to the link that the Megillah draws between the two, Ahasuerus's attitude towards his material possessions and Ahasuerus's attitude towards his wife, by describing the classic Megillah, the classic Gemara, Megillah Yud Beis, where all the different people at the party are talking about the beauty of their respective wives, the Medios Naos, the Parsios Naos. This is really a very classy conversation they're having at the party. Which nationality boasts the most beautiful women? Amar Lehem Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus says, Kli she'ani mishtamish bo. Right? The vessel that I use. It's exceptionally uncouth language. But it's not just the language is uncouth. Right? Chazal are getting at the point that Ahasuerus looks at Vashti as no different from the beautiful golden and silver vessels that he is showing off. And then Chazal say, of course, Ritzon chem lerosa, you want to see her. And the people say, Amrulo, in, yes, uvulvan shetehe aruma, but really show her off. Show her off without wearing any clothes. Reading the pasuk literally, right? She's going to wear the crown and wear nothing else. So we learned this story as a kid, but what Chazal are getting at here is that we see Ahasuerus, it's all out there, you know, in a way which completely breaches the basic norms of tznius that one would have, right? And it's obvious to us when it comes to the king's wife, you know, the queen should not be presented to people anyway. She certainly shouldn't be presented to people without wearing any clothing. The truth is, that's exactly what Ahasuerus is doing with all of his treasure. You know, Shlomo HaMelech was fantastically rich. You don't invite people in to see all your stuff, okay? Someone's blessed with terrific riches. There's an idea of privacy. There's an idea of class. There's an idea of you're better than this. But that's not Ahasuerus. She is obsessed with the idea of liharos, to display things which should be hidden. Ahasuerus is revealing. And it is not only the riches in the palace, liharos. It's not only his wife. Once Chazal are onto this, we find other examples as well. So we know when we get to the line in the Megillah about the vessels, Ashkos Klei Zahav V'cheilim, V'cheilim Shonim, right? We talk about the different vessels, these sort of vessels that Ahasuerus serves, and we use the trap from Eicha because there's a very, very strong tradition in Chazal that these were not just any ordinary vessels, rather that these were the Klei Shares, these were the golden and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the Beis HaMikdash, the vessels of Kedusha, the vessels of sanctity, which Nebuchadnezzar took from Yerushalayim and brought to Babel. Then Sefer Daniel describes in Belshazzar's famous party, right, where you have the writing on the wall. So Belshazzar's grandfather never dared to touch the Klei Shares. They were in the treasure house, but even Nebuchadnezzar had the respect to understand you don't party with the, you know, with the vessels you took from the temple. Evil Merodach, Belshazzar's father, understood. Those vessels, you put them in your treasury, but you don't bring them out for the party. Belshazzar doesn't get the memo. He thinks that it's been 70 years, and he's confident he brings them out. Described in Daniel Parak A. I put it right down over here. You know, the last time in history, in Jewish history, we've seen a king throwing a tremendous feast and getting drunk with all of his wives and concubines and lords and everything, was the drunken feast of Belshazzar. He brought out the vessels of Yerushalayim, which never should be brought out and put on display. And Chazal are understanding that Ahasuerus is doing the same thing. Those vessels which belong inside the Beis HaMikdash are now being put on display for all the people. So we have Ahasuerus putting on a show with his money. We have Ahasuerus putting on a show with his wife. Ahasuerus putting on a show with the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, things which are all supposed to be kept on the inside, Achashverosh lets it all out there. There's one more. There's one more very important point for us to note about how Achashverosh is not somebody who keeps things in. He is somebody who lets them out. That is Achashverosh's emotional comportment. Twice we have in the Megillah, right? The description the Megillah has of Achashverosh's rage. When Vashti refuses to come, so the pasuk doesn't just tell us that Achashverosh was angry. Ve'ktof ha-melech ma'od, he was extremely angry. V'chamaso ba'arabo, and his anger, burned inside of him. The anger of the king is a theme in the Megillah. We have it later with Haman. V'ha-melech kam b'chamaso. Achashverosh is so angry, he has to get up and he has to take a walk around in the garden. Achashverosh is not a cool and collected customer. Right? He's somebody who gets angry very easily. And if we consider the way Achashverosh shows off his money, the way Achashverosh is so prone to anger, and the way that Achashverosh is so prone to getting drunk, we have the trifecta of things which the Gemara tells us in Erevin. You want to get to know someone's inner nature? Look at these three. Amar Rabbi Elai, v'shlosha dvarim adam nikar. You want to get to know somebody? Look at three things. Bekoso is what he's like when he's drunk. Bekiso, look at what it does with his money. Bukaso, and look at what he's like when he's angry. Those three are the way to really get to someone's inside. And Achashverosh is somebody who lets it all out there. The man's getting drunk. The man's getting furious. The man is showing off all of his money. So what should be inside is all in the out. And that really defines Achashverosh. Before we continue, we should just pause and note that there's a massive contrast over here, which really confirms that we're on to something much deeper. And we're not going to explore this so much tonight. But of course, if Achashverosh is the quintessential person of revealing, Esther is the quintessential example of keeping things hidden. I mean, literally, the name Esther. She's the one who isn't telling Achashverosh where she comes from. She's the one who's playing her cards so close to the chest as she goes through the whole Megillah, manipulating Achashverosh and getting to the point where she can take care of Haman. Right? Esther is the model of real tzniah. She's the one who keeps things on the inside. She's the one who's keeping things hidden. Achashverosh is the one who has things out in the open. That's a contrast that we really need to keep in mind. It's definitely something that we're going to be coming back to. But let's now take things to the next level. Right? So we've documented pretty thoroughly, I think, that Achashverosh is a man of externals, putting things on the outside. The stuff that should be hidden is not. It's all the display. It's all putting on a show. There's a very particular show that Achashverosh is interested in putting on. There's a very particular image that he wants to give off to the world. And once we notice that, it's going to unlock a new level of understanding into Achashverosh's character and really the character of the whole Persian empire that he rules and that Klal Yisrael in this point in time are struggling to deal with. I label this part of the shir to infinity and beyond because Achashverosh loves to present an image to the world that he has infinite resources. And this comes up again and again and again and again. So we begin in Perek Aleph. When what is he showing off? He's not just showing off his honor and his wealth, right? But the Megillah gives us in like gory detail everything that he has. Chur, Karpas, Tacheles, Achos, this treasure, that fabric, this wine, this vessel, that vessel. It's infinite. It's infinite. And how long does it go on for? Yamim rabim shmonim umas yom, 180 days. The resources for the party are infinite, and the time for the party is infinite. Right? There's no stopping this. There's no limit to Achashverosh's ability to party. That is the first message the Megillah wants us to have of Achashverosh. He is somebody who is showing off the unlimited resources of the Persian Empire. Osher kivod malchuso, v'as yakar teferes gedulaso. Now, you know, we think back to Sefer Melachim, and what was the glorious accomplishment of Malchus Yehuda? It was the Beis HaMikdash. So Achashverosh, it's a party. For us, it was the Beis HaMikdash. But this creation, this image of infinite resource, doesn't just end in Perek Aleph, right? We continue on to Perek Beis, and we have this same message given. when Achashverosh is gathering in all the women of the empire to decide who's going to be his wife, right? Vikvetsu es kol ara besulam, an endless supply of women for Achashverosh. Infinite. It doesn't end. Look at this glorious king. He can sleep with a different woman every single night of the year without end, right? There's no limit to his appetite, and there's no limit to what he can bring in. It's infinite. How are the women prepared? Again, it's not just a few hours. It's not just a couple of days. 6 months and 6 months, a year. Infinite time, infinite resources being spent on each woman for her one night with Achashverosh. The Persian Empire can sustain anything. There are no limits onto what Achashverosh is putting towards the people. Achashverosh's attitude towards money generally is like this. Right? Achashverosh makes another party after he hires Queen Esther. After he selects Esther to be the queen. And what does he do? V'hanachalim, do you know, Sosa? He cuts everyone a tax break. How can he cut a tax break? He's partied for 180 days. He's just spent the rest of the money the palace has bringing in all these women from everywhere and showering them with everything he has, right? And somehow now is the time for a tax break? You know, modern politics, we talk about the conundrum of guns and butter. You know, can you support the economy while also supporting the war? Achashverosh says, I have it all. I have infinite money. You want a tax break? Sure, no problem. I'll spend whatever I want. There's no limit to what I can spend, and I don't even need to bring things in. It's infinite. And let's throw another party. And then one parak later, it comes up again. Haman turns to Achashverosh and says, I'll give you, 10,000 kikar of silver, like the GDP of half the empire, an unfathomable sum of money. What does Achashverosh say to him? Who, by now, in a normal sense, you'd think that the kingdom could really use a few shekels. And Achashverosh says, HaKesef nasun lach. I don't need your money. I don't need your money. I have everything. Right? Achashverosh, the way he portrays himself when it comes to money is it's infinite. And then we have this theme come up one more time, if this wasn't enough, right? His attitude towards the women, the initial party, what he says to Haman. And then, of course, for the rest of the Megillah, Perek Hey, Perek Vav, Perek Zion, Perek Ches, Achashverosh keeps on telling Esther again and again and again, whatever you want, you can have. What do you want? What do you want? I can give you anything. Achashverosh portrays himself as the genie from Aladdin, right? I can give you whatever you want. That is the image that Achashverosh portrays. So he is someone who is showing off everything he has, and he is portraying himself as if he has it all. And that is where that last or second to last pasuk of the Megillah is so critical and important. Because this is going to begin to unravel everything that we've built up about Achashverosh. Because what was the last thing the Megillah tells us that Achashverosh does? Vayasam hamelach Achashverosh, mas ala aretz diyei haya. Finally, the bill comes due. Achashverosh needs to impose a tax on the whole empire and all the surrounding coasts and islands. Because it turns out that Achashverosh, the glorious king of the glorious empire of Persia, who can spend and spend and spend infinite resources, it turns out that it's a lie. The money isn't infinite. The bill is going to come due. You know, it's funny. Some of the Mepharshim actually say that this is a credit to Mordechai. Like Mordechai comes on as the second in command, and he takes a look at the finances, and he's like, oh my gosh, this place is a disaster. It's time for us to actually get the financial house in order over here. We got to actually raise taxes. But I think what the Megillah does, putting this at the end, is showing us the entire image of infinite that Achashverosh portrayed, that he worked so hard to present to everybody. It's a lie. There is a limit to the resources. This whole empire is really built on the taxation and extraction and oppression of 127 provinces. You dig a little bit underneath the gilded surface of Shushan, and you realize what's actually funding all this isn't some magical money tree. It's the mas ala aretz. It is the forcible extraction from the people. And as soon as that would end, the party would end as well. He actually does not have infinite. And once we notice that, the last thing the Megillah told us about Achashverosh is that the image he's been portraying to everybody really is false. Turns out the man does not have infinite resources to shower endlessly. Now we can look back and realize how other ways Ahasuerus portrays himself are really false as well, right? So we talked about the money. So Ahasuerus is the king of kings, supposedly. Yeah, that was actually, historically, that was the formal title that the Persians take. You know, they took this from the Babylonians took this from the Assyrians, as the king of kings. That's why in Sefer Daniel, so what do we call Hashem? Hashem is the Melech Malchei Hamlachtim, right? Hashem is the king of kings. Because the king of kings is Nebuchadnezzar, the king of kings is Ahasuerus, so we'll raise you one, and Ibn Shalom is the king of kings. But the Persian kings call themselves the king of kings, we're the ultimate. Now let's see, is that really true? In one sense, yes, right, for sure. Ahasuerus has terrifying unlimited power. He wants to raise someone up, we can raise him up. He wants to kill someone, you know, they're dead as soon as he doesn't even have to, you know, snaps a finger, they're gone. Whole nations can be destroyed. Taxes, women brought in to be raped, nations being oppressed. Do whatever he wants. Ahasuerus's whim is the rule of the land. Unlimited power, right? Right? Maybe not, because as we know, when push comes to shove, and Esther finally says to Ahasuerus, okay, can you please, you know, retract the law you passed to wipe out the Jews? Not even maybe knowing it was the Jews you're wiping out. That's not so clear. So what does Ahasuerus tell them? He says, well, I can't retract it because anything which any law which was passed and sealed with the ring of the king cannot be undone. So Ahasuerus, there are limits on his power. Right? He can't overturn his own thing. He's so desperate to please his wife. You know, Chazal is going to make fun about this in a little bit. Right? He can't. He was so angry at his like chief minister. He had him killed, and now he can't even undo the law that he himself did. In a sense, it shows the patheticness of the king. You know, contrasted with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, the first thing we know about Hashem. You know, Hashem can tear up the gzera. That's like, you know, one of the most basic things we have is how Hashem runs the world. In the Teshuvah, what Hashem had decided can be torn up. Ahasuerus, maybe the king of kings, but he can't even override his own laws. So the lie is beginning to unravel, right? The image was unlimited wealth. But the last thing the Megillah tells us, it gives us a wink, we know that's not true. We have the image of unlimited power, but as soon as the first point of pressure hits, we realize that's a facade. It's not true either. Let's think for a second. I need this chart over here. You know, Ahasuerus is all powerful. He does whatever he wants, right? You know, the story of the Megillah is Ahasuerus doing whatever he wants. The story of the Megillah, from a certain perspective, is Ahasuerus being manipulated by different people in every single paragraph. You know, the king is almost like a vessel. You know, Chazal had Ahasuerus calling Vashti a vessel. But anyways, the joke is on Ahasuerus, because Ahasuerus himself is the vessel for whichever person happens to have his ear in the moment to use to his own ends. Ahasuerus does almost nothing in the Megillah. I tried to put a list of things Ahasuerus himself does of his own initiative. And I really came up with three. If someone wants to throw in one or two that I missed, I'd be happy for you to do so. Put it in the chat. Maybe there's one or two that I missed. But Ahasuerus, he throws a party at the beginning of the Megillah. He throws a party for Esther, and he makes a tax. Other than that, and you know, promoting and demoting various people, he promotes a queen, demotes a queen, promotes an advisor, demotes an advisor. In terms of things that Ahasuerus actually does, you know, activities, programs, projects that he embarks on, he has the infinite unlimited power of the Persian Empire. What does he do with it? Nothing. There's no war, there's no building project. I think about the kings, you know, think about David and Shlomo. There's nothing like building a Beis HaMikdash, there's nothing like war, there are no peace treaties. What does he do? The man, the ostensible alleged king of kings who has unlimited power, doesn't do a thing. He throws a couple parties and he raises a tax to finally belatedly pay for the party that he throws. Meanwhile, what's happening with him throughout the whole Megillah? What happens to Paragala? He has advisors who tell him what to do with Vashti. Yeah? Wasn't Ahasuerus' idea to go to Vashti? It was a Muchan's idea. What happens to Perak Beis? He has advisors who tell him how to find a new queen. It wasn't him. That was the Nari HaMelech. That was his lad who told him what to do. What happens to Perak Gimel? He has Haman telling him, hey, let's wipe out the Jews. Or let's wipe out some nation. And Achashverosh, sure, go ahead, blank check. Here's the ring, sign it. Do we want? You know, Achashverosh, he doesn't appear in Perek Dalet. Perek Dalet doesn't count. Perek Hey, Esther walks in the room, and Achashverosh, what happens? Esther says, come to my party. It wasn't Achashverosh. Achashverosh says, sure, no problem. Perek Vav, what happens? Well, then he goes to Esther, Esther invites him to the second party. Perek Vav, Haman suggests the reward for Mordechai. It wasn't Achashverosh's idea to put Mordechai on the horse and give him the clothes. It was Haman's idea. Perek Zion, killing Haman. Why does Achashverosh kill Haman? Because remember, Harvona jumps in. He says, oh, remember the tree that Haman set up to hang Mordechai. Every single Perek, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Hey, Vav, Zion, it's someone else who is manipulating and getting the king to do something else. That happens in Perek Ches. That's when Mordechai and Esther come to Achashverosh about signing off on a law to get the Jews to defend themselves. And what does Achashverosh do? Gives Mordechai his ring. Here, you guys sign whatever you want. Stamp it with my ring. Peace out. I'm gone. You'll find me getting drunk. Yeah. And then Perek Tes, Esther comes back and says, okay, I have a new request. Can I hang Haman's sons and an extra fighting day in Shushan? Everything that happens in the Megillah, all the actual activities, are different people using the power of the king. So we see this guy who's displaying an image of himself as all-powerful, all-wealthy, and as we dig into that, it turns out that it's all a lie. It's all a facade, and what's underneath the mask of infinite is much, much less. A weak, manipulated person who actually has far less than he pretends to. You know, it turns out there was an infinite money. What does he do? In practice, what does he do? He bankrupts the country. Chazal have a line about this as well. I'm talking about the rash, you know, the poverty that's caused by Achashverosh. Regular kings, they raise taxes, they go to war, they raise taxes, they build infrastructure, they build up the economy. What does he do? He raises money and he just burns it on parties. He doesn't actually do anything with all the power he supposedly has. And Chazal just have a couple of just great lines, just totally slicing Achashverosh to pieces. One is Esther Rab over here. So Achashverosh, and so the Megillah says, Achashverosh, who Achashverosh? Achashverosh, he is Achashverosh. And the idea that Chazal have about this is that Achashverosh can be so weak and so two-faced that he'll do one thing one minute and the next thing the next minute. You know, he's like a walking Benahafahu, except in a pathetic way, not in the way we sing about it after Megillah. So we have here Menachem Yachad, Amar Achashverosh, Shaharek Ishto, Mipnei Oavo. In Perek Aleph, the man kills his wife because of his friend. Right? Memuchan says, oh, get rid of Vashti. That's what he does. Hu Achashverosh, Shaharek Oavo, Mipnei Ishto. It's the same guy who a few broken later kills his friend because of his wife. So in Perek Aleph, he kills his wife because of his friend. In Perek Zion, he kills his friend because of his wife. He's just being led. He's being led over here. He's being led over there. The other view in Chazal, it gets into Sefer Ezra a little bit, where we find out there's one other place in Tanakh where Achashverosh appears, in Sefer Ezra, we're told he wrote a sitna. He wrote a decree of oppression against the Jews of Yerushalayim. Chazal understand that he caused the Beis HaMikdash to stop being built, and later on, he gives license for it to be built again. But he's a flip-flopper, you know, and the reason why he's a flip-flopper is he has none of his own principles. All the power the man supposedly holds is just being used by other people. Rabban Gamliel, you know, Rabban Gamliel was the Nasi during a hard time, so Rabban Gamliel knows a thing or two about leadership. Rabban Gamliel, the Megillah, looks at Achashverosh, and he just sums him up. It's a bit of a tongue twister. But he says, Melach hafach v'chan haya. It's a flip-flopper. There's no integrity. There's no sense of mission. There's no sense of accomplishment. One minute, he's being controlled by his advisor, who's telling him to kill his wife. The next minute, he's being controlled by his wife, who's telling him to kill his advisor. That's all there is to the man. Behind the facade, he's just an empty suit. There's one more piece. Well, I have two more. But to understand, you know, this supposedly all-powerful king. Soloveitchik has an essay about this. And Yoni Grossman on the VBM does some good work on this as well. I want to show a diuk in this for the Pesukim. Achashverosh, the idea is paranoid. Yonah Gros just puts it well, you know, if you think about it, in the beginning of the Megillah, when we have the assassination attempt of Bigson and Teresh, so Esther has no problem getting to the king. You know, there are no elaborate security protocols. There's no, you can only come when you're invited. Mordechai gives the intel to Esther. Esther goes to Achashverosh. Dunskis, not all Torah. All of a sudden, we get to Parak Hay, and there's this whole, you can't, or Parak Dalet even, you can't go to the king unless you've been invited. Well, where was that two Prakim ago? And why is it so out of the blue that Haman is promoted above all the other ministers in Parak Gimel? The argument is, Achashverosh becomes paranoid and terrified of assassination after the Bigson and Teresh assassination attempt. And he promotes Haman to basically be the head of security, the chief bodyguard. Think about it. Haman is able to access the king on demand. You know, when Achashverosh wakes up from his sleep, Haman can walk straight in. No one else can. Anybody else, you have to clear protocol. Everything is centralized under one man. Achashverosh then enters a bubble. The person who is supposedly so powerful lives his life paranoid of being assassinated. And Chazal described how Esther is able to manipulate this fear with, there's going to be a party with just Achashverosh and Esther and Haman, getting Haman to think, getting Achashverosh, sorry, to think, maybe even my queen and my one advisor are plotting against me. The man who supposedly rules the world wakes up every morning and goes to sleep every night, terrified of being poisoned in his sleep. Right? He's terrified. And there's one place where you see this come through if you read the Megillah very carefully. So Achashverosh is awake at night in Perek Vav, and then they read the story of Bigson and Teresh and Mordechai, who is never rewarded. Megillah says, "Yom Melech, Mana say Yekar Gdula LeMordechai Elzeh." So they're in the bedroom. What was the glory done for Mordechai? "Yom Nari Melech Mishar Sav, Lo Nasei Mo Davar." Hey, they're in the bedroom, and that's what happens. Out of the blue, Vayomer HaMelech mi bechatzer. The king says, "Who's in the courtyard?" Let's try to recreate the scene for a second. Achashverosh is in his bedchamber. He has a few lackeys around who are reading him a bedtime story. And then all of a sudden, the king erupts and he says, "Who's in the courtyard?" Meaning, Achashverosh hears the footsteps in the courtyard before anyone else. He's always listening. You know, it wasn't that you would think that somebody from the outside, Haman would walk into the chatzar outside. You'd have a guard or somebody see Haman coming. The guard would come into Achashverosh and say, "Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness, the King of Kings of Persia, Haman is coming in to see you." That's how you'd expect it to go. You know, you don't have a case where, I would say Queen Elizabeth, I guess now King Charles, says, "Who's outside?" No. The outer guard rings the bell. They ring the bell. They say, "Here is somebody coming in for their audience with the king." The fact that Achashverosh immediately erupts, mi bechatzer, before anyone else has told us, shows us that he is always listening. You know, he may be in the room with you listening to a story. He always has one ear cocked outside, one eye on the back of his head. Who's out there? Who's coming? Who's trying to get? He's terrified. He's paranoid. Right? Haman had come to the outer courtyard. And yet before anyone else in the room, Achashverosh is on that and he is worried and wondering and asking urgently, Mibachatzer, who's there? Who's there? Who's there? The mask slips for a second. And you see the fear which is driving the supposedly secure and all-powerful king. Now, the last piece that Chazal put in on this to understand Achashverosh. And I think to really understand this, we're going to need to understand the criticism we're having of the Empire of Persia as a whole. So the Megillah began and told us, "Hu Achashverosh ha-molech mehodu v'yarkush." Now, it didn't say he ruled ha-malach, ha-molech, right? He's ruling. So Rashi explained, and this idea is all over Chazal, ha-molech. Shemalach me'atzmo, velo mizera hamlucha haya. Achashverosh was not a member of the royal family. He gets himself in as king. He usurps the throne. Now, if you look at some of the history of Persia, there's a little bit of speculation here, but I think this is something that Chazal were driving at. So the consensus view is that Ahasuerus is Xerxes, right? The emperor who goes and tries to attack Greece. We know the founder of the Persian Empire was Cyrus, right? Koresh. There's basically a usurpation. Xerxes, Ahasuerus' father, Dayavesh, usurps the throne. He basically takes it over. So Ahasuerus' family is illegitimate. They shouldn't be the ones really ruling. I think Ahasuerus has chosen to be the next king because his wife has yichus to Koresh. So he's used to kind of present themselves as being really from the legitimate royal line. But Ahasuerus really is the one who shouldn't be the king. This all-powerful person, this Melech Malcha, this Melech HaMlachim, really does not have royal legitimacy. And not only does Ahasuerus not have royal legitimacy, but Persia doesn't have royal legitimacy either. I put a map over here so you can kind of get a sense, right? And you think, where were the glorious old kings and kingdoms in the time of Tanakh? So of course, we have Mitzrayim over here, and here's Eretz Yisrael. You have Ashur over here, and you have Bavel over there. In Sefer Yehoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Malachim, you never hear of Persia. You never hear of Paras. The reason why is because Persia is in the middle of nowhere. It's way out here in the boondocks. They're a nothing. They're a nobody. There's no such thing, historically, as the kingdom of Persia during the time of David, during the time of Shlomo, during the time of most of the first base of Mikdash. You have a bunch of nomads who show up into the area. The rulers are Ashur. The rulers are Bavel. And so Chazal have all these midrashim contrasting Ahasuerus, what they call a stable boy, with Nebuchadnezzar or with Belshazzar. And I think what Chazal are driving at is that the Persians are a bunch of nomads. You know, they've only achieved independence. The first independent king in the history of Persia was Koresh, who was like 5 minutes ago. You know, it's ironic because Mordechai and Esther right now are in exile. And they're trying to flatter and please and manipulate and deal with this king of kings. But their royal lineage goes way, way, way farther than that of Ahasuerus. Because they are descendants of Shaul ben Kish. Shaul was the king in Eretz Yisrael 500 years before there was a king of Persia. The royal lineage of Mordechai and Esther is far more established for sure than that of Ahasuerus, who's barely holding on to the throne because his father was never supposed to be the king. But the Persians in general are this, you know, Johnny-come-lately kingdom. They're not the rulers. Bavel's been the ruler. Asher's been the ruler. That's what Chazal are getting at over here. So behind the facade of infinite wealth and infinite power and all the royalty is somebody who is really, the kingdom is broke. The power is just used by other people. He's being manipulated left and right. The person who seems so secure is living paranoid every single day. And this glorious kingdom of Persia is really nothing, which just came along 5 minutes ago and pales in comparison with even Bavel or Ashur and Kal Vachomer with Bnei Yisrael and with the descendants of Shaul ben Kish. He's not a real king. And this then gets us to the last, I think the real reason why Ahasuerus is so essential for the Megillah. Because Megillah, it's all about masks and facades. What things are like on the outside is not what things are like on the inside. And that is certainly true for Ahasuerus. But why is it so important that the way things look like are not the way things are? The answer is because that is what life in the Galus is all about. We know the one being who never appears by name in the Megillah is the Melech Malchei HaMelachim. Hashem doesn't appear in the Megillah. It seems like everything is being run by chance and everything is being run by politics and everything is being run by the people who are close to the king. That's the way things are like on the outside. But just like the outside is just a facade, and if you scratch through Ahasuerus, you realize how different things are underneath, the same is true for how the Ribbono Shalom runs the world. And Chazal have the Medrash in Esther Rabbah, and whenever you find HaMelech Ahasuerus, it's Ahasuerus. Whenever you find HaMelech, it can be a reference to Hashem as well. The term Melech shows up so many times in Megillah, it's ridiculous. It's like almost 200 times. Just to give you a sense, I think there are 167 psukim in Megillah, so that the word Melech appears more times than there are psukim in the Megillah. Okay? It doesn't stop. Melech, 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 every 2 seconds. And yet, who's the real Melech? The real Melech is not Achashverosh. The real Melech is the Kadosh. The real Melech is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? This is the way things are. The way things look like, it looks like the king is Achashverosh. The way things are, the king is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's why it's so important for this to be Megillas Achashverosh. He, in so many ways, is the pivotal character, because everything he stands for is the whole message of the Megillah. The way things look like in this world is not the way things actually are. And there's just one last point that I saw. I saw the Dat Mikra make this point, which I thought was very, very interesting. The Dat Mikra picks up on the very beginning of the Megillah. And he says over here that the language the Megillah uses, you know, those who are around for the Brachos parallels know that I totally love these. So the Dat Mikra suggests, Yoter demachu the lashon haTorah b'ptichat maaseh machan arba malachim et hachamisha. The way the Megillah introduces the reign of Achashverosh, that Mikra suggests, is really heavily borrowing from, of all places, and we'll see why, I think, the battle of the four kings and the five kings in Parshas Lech Lecha. How so? We're told, Vayhi bimei Achashverosh, right? It was in the days of Achashverosh. Who was the king? The only time we have this, right? Vayhi bimei Amraphel, Melech Shinar. It was in the days. The other, David, Shlomo, any Jewish king you have in Sefer Melachim, you never have Vayhi bimei X, the king of so-and-so. You have it with Achashverosh, you have it with the four kings and the five kings. You know? And then what do they do? In their days, Achashverosh made a party, and they made a war. Asa mishteh, asu melchama. Okay, what's the point? Why would the beginning of the Megillah use language, reference to that ancient story of the four kings and the five kings, the captivity of Lot, Avraham who rescues them, and the shoelace? What does that have to do with what's going on in Esther and Persia? So the answer is as follows. Talked about this in a shir a couple of years ago. In that story, it's another place where, once again, kings come out of the woodwork, right? The word Melech is used again and again and again and again. It's the first time. The first time in the Torah really introduced the kings is the four kings and the five kings. You have Amraphel Melech Shinar, Aryoch Melech Elasar. The Torah like goes out of its way to talk about all of these kings. It could have said there were four kings. We didn't know their names. We don't even know their countries, but there. This guy was the king of X. It's like the lineup introductions to a football game, you know? He's the safety from, University of Miami, and he's the cornerback from the University of Michigan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We get it, okay? But we have to have all of them. And then we have more kings coming out. You know, the Malki Tzedek, Melech Yerushalayim shows up. Kings, 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 kings. What's the point? What's the point? The end. There's only one person in that whole story who wasn't the king. You know, it was those kings fighting those kings, this king's coming out. One person who wasn't a king in the whole story is doing something is Avraham Avinu, right? He's the only non-king in the whole story. And what does Avraham say at the end? After all those kings come and go, who does Hashem, who does Avraham represent? The Omer Avraham Melech Sodom, Harimosi Yadi El Hashem Kel Elyon Koneh Shemayim Ba'aretz. Who does Avraham represent? Who does he stand for? Who is he loyal to? Hashem, right? The great God who actually runs the whole heaven and the whole earth. So there are all these kings in the world. The first time we were ever introduced to kings, Avraham Avinu told us, yeah, we have some powerful kings, we have some less powerful kings, some kings win, and some kings lose. At the end of the day, none of them are the real king. The real king is Hashem, Yudke Vavke, Konei, Shamayim, Ba'aretz. And the Megillah beginning with Achashverosh, it's yet another way of getting us to the same point. We can look at the outside and the way things seem, the way things appear. Glorious Persia, powerful Persia, a king who's infinitely powerful. He can do whatever he wants. He has whatever he wants. Dig underneath, v'nahapahu. everything is the opposite. Everything is backwards. Where the power seems to be, it isn't at all. And the being who's actually running the world, the true Melech, is the one who doesn't even appear in the Megillah at all. So that's why I think we have Megillah Sachashverosh, the facade, and then underneath it, the truth. So we'll stop.